A new investigation by the Washington Post has revealed that the Israeli army is photographing tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians, adults, and children, and then using these images to build a massive facial recognition database. According to the report, the facial recognition technology is then deployed against these same civilians to limit movement and constrain the lives of the Palestinian population. Former soldiers told the Washington Post that units were incentivized to compete with one another to collect the most civilian photographs. Now, to better understand what's at stake in this practice, I spoke with Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent.
When I first started asking questions about, tell me what's the extent of digital surveillance in Israel's occupied territories, it was like nobody in Israel could give me an answer. And that is because the Israeli army has huge claims around state secrets for their technology. But what I learned through a bunch of luck and a bunch of reporting is that there's been this vastly expanded digital surveillance in the last 2 years. And that includes this network of smartphones. It's a program that is called Blue Wolf. One soldier described it to me as a secret Facebook for Palestinians that the Israeli army keeps. The way it was described to me is that when the Israeli army was building this database, they would give smartphones to unit commanders and people on a patrol in the city of Hebron and other parts of the West Bank. And they would be told to take as many photographs of Palestinians as possible. And that includes children and the elderly. And they would upload the photographs. And if the photographs had a match, you know, with an existing photo in the Blue Wolf app, then a profile would come up. And the profile would flash red, yellow, or green to say if the person should be arrested immediately, detained, or allowed to pass. The other component that I learned about is when I went to Hebron, people would tell me, you know, in addition to having our photos taken all the time, you know, this city is kind of strung up with checkpoints everywhere. It's within a city, so it's not like a checkpoint to enter Israel. It's just checkpoints that control people's movements. And when they walk to the checkpoints, which are part of daily life there, they would tell me that in the last 6-7 months, when they walk to the checkpoint, the soldiers manning the checkpoint recognize them before they give their ID, which is what you need to pass through. And later I spoke with a soldier who said that, in fact, there has been this broader expansion of facial recognition there. And it can also recognize vehicles. It can tie a vehicle to a person. And then the third component is kind of like you have to, I think, imagine this very dystopian reality that people live in the West Bank, which is In certain parts where I was, there's cameras just everywhere put up by the army.
My iPhone has pictures of my friends, my family, and it will guess who a new picture is. So I have a nephew, and my nephew McKinley, my iPhone typically thinks McKinley is everything from a six-month-old infant to my elderly grandparent. I mean, like seriously, at any point it will say, oh, is this McKinley, right? It'll think that McKinley is a baby or it'll think McKinley is a white woman, like just all the things that McKinley might be. And it's clearly doing a very bad job at recognizing McKinley's face. But I'm wondering if sort of even, so we'll get to the question of even if the facial recognition is right, but I want to first start with, from a algorithmic standpoint, how much should we even trust that this facial recognition is seeing, right, sort of in an AI kind of way, that it's seeing who it thinks it's seeing?
That is exactly the problem. What you're talking about is Apple's custom facial recognition. But one thing we know is that there's wide degrees of accuracy around facial recognition technologies, despite the fact that there is a huge march. In the last few years, even in the United States, there's been a major expansion of the use of facial recognition technology by law enforcement agencies, TSA, the FBI. It was used during the January 6th insurrection investigations as well, these face matching software. So they're all over the place. Lots of companies build these kinds of tools, and there's varying degrees of accuracy. One thing we know is researchers have done studies which say that the accuracy for faces with darker skin, so if your nephew is black, it's going to have a lower accuracy. So we know that there's lower accuracy with darker skinned faces. We know there's some lower accuracy with women. And then you could think about in the Palestinian territories, you know, these are women. A lot of them are also wearing head coverings if they're religious. So maybe there's fabric that conceals some of the face. And so, yeah, I mean, there's huge questions of whether that matching is correct.
Is there any sense of a legal or ethical requirement to gain consent before taking someone's photograph?
I mean, I think that there's a huge sense of that in a democracy. And the West Bank and the Palestinian Israel is democracy, but its occupied territories are not run like a democracy. It's a military controlled area. And you see this also in parts of China as well. You know, this is why many, many activists and experts have said to me that places where people have limited freedom, that is the testing ground for surveillance technologies. Just as a case in point, in Israel, you know, right 45 minutes away from the West Bank, or in some cases 5 minutes because of the way the borders are drawn, there is a huge debate right now going on about the ability for police to use facial recognition cameras in public places. That's not just taking a photo on the street. That's using facial recognition that the Israeli government's privacy authority has advised against doing, the very thing that they're doing to the Palestinian population. And to your question about taking photos of people, I mean, yeah, how would you feel if somebody stopped you on the street and said, I'm going to need to take your picture? You would say, back off. Like, why are you taking my picture? Like, you would have all these questions and rights and you wouldn't allow it. And people in an occupied territory, people under military rule, you know, they don't have those rights. They don't have the legal recourse. And I should add, the soldiers themselves who were tasked to do this, at least the ones that I interviewed, were super traumatized by it. They really saw how even taking people's pictures, you know, what a privacy violation people felt that was. And they were being asked to take pictures of elderly people and elderly women who may be religious. They may not want to take off the headscarf, children. And, you know, what risk could little children pose? What is the rationale? A lot of them were wondering that themselves. And again, this was devised as a form of competition for soldiers as well. So whichever unit took the most pictures in a week would get a prize, like a night off. It was actually gamified by the Army.
All right, so you get what's at stake here. Now, that was Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent. Now, here to talk to us on the implications of this targeted surveillance against Palestinians and what it could mean in other parts of the world is non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in D.C., Youssef Munayyer. I started off by asking Youssef about how this surveillance program differs from surveillance that we've seen in the past.
This is just the sort of latest technological step to enable what has been a longstanding practice of deep, deep surveillance of Palestinian society by the Israeli state and the Israeli military. And, you know, as time marches on and technology advances, we're learning about new methods that are being used. And this is, you know, just sort of the most recent one. But of course, everything from cyber surveillance to phone tapping, to spy networks have been, you know, used historically by the Israeli military and the Israeli state against the Palestinian people in occupied territory and beyond. So I think, you know, what of course makes this different, a little bit different, is, you know, what makes all of these technological advances in surveillance technology so much more dangerous. And that's the speed and the scale and the scope at which the state can collect information, readily access that information, and then weaponize or operationalize it. And when you have, you know, at the touch of, a button, the facial images being matched of, you know, potentially millions of people, there's a tremendous amount of power in that, and a tremendous opportunity for misuse and abuse, as is the case with any form of vast surveillance network. This is just, as I said, the latest step in what's been a longstanding practice that's, you know, really, really born out of a situation of fundamental inequality. I think, your previous guest, you know, made an important point in noting that there is, in occupied Palestinian territory, no citizenship rights for Palestinians. No civil liberties for Palestinians, no reasonable expectation to privacy, and so on. There is military rule. And of course, the state has tremendous power over the population and is not really limited by any sort of framework of civil rights and liberties, because it doesn't exist there. So what ends up happening in spaces like the Occupy Palestinian territory is that these sorts of technologies are used to extents and in ways that are probably not possible anywhere else in the world, where there would be, certainly not in the advanced world, where you would have much greater sort of limitations on the power and the reach of government surveillance. So, Palestinians end up becoming something of a laboratory for technology, which is being developed, but importantly also then exported around the world. And I think this is one of the important dimensions of this.
Can you talk to me a bit about what it means to live under that level of surveillance at all times?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. It is, there is a constant sense that you are under watch, under control, and that there is, a panopticon all around you. The situation in different parts of Palestinian territory varies, right? When it comes to this sort of physical surveillance and the shape of cameras. But when we talk about like movement and access throughout the West Bank, there are restrictions, checkpoints in many different places. And then you have, of course, a massive network of settlements and military bases throughout the territory, all of which come with their own attached surveillance infrastructure. Security agents, military soldiers, and so on, operating the movement and access throughout this entire space. So you are constantly under the eye of the military, constantly. And especially when you try to move from one place to the other, in some places like Hebron, for example, where Elizabeth was, it's even moving, across the street is something that cannot happen without deep, deep military surveillance of your activities.
In what ways are these experiences of Palestinians, both as a matter of the technology and the lived experience you just talked with us about, why is that a kind of miner's canary for those of us in other parts of the world?
Yeah, as I said, so Palestinians are this really unique, unfortunately, this really unique testing ground, because there are so little limitations on state power that you can get away with a kind of surveillance that you probably won't in a lot of other places. And this has allowed the Israeli military really hone and refine various different surveillance technologies that can then be marketed through its own military intelligence industry to other countries around the world. And we know for a fact that, the NSO Group, which is one of these Israeli corporations that is having its products authorized for sale by the Israeli Defense Ministry to other governments, is selling surveillance technology to other regimes around the world, which has been implicated in the surveillance and targeting of human rights activists, of journalists, for example, like Jamal Khashoggi and the people around him, and many others. So, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that these techniques, these methods of surveillance, of repression, which are being tested and perfected on Palestinians, are not staying in Palestine. As important it is to understand what is happening in Palestine, it's also important to understand that they are coming to a state near you in the near future. Because of how integrated the state of Israel is into the sort of global, you know, national security regime and within the sort of broader family of Western allies, it's very possible that the types of technology, surveillance technology, repressive methods that are perfected on Palestinians might be sold to our government, might be sold to other allied governments in Europe, and in fact have been, right? And used on people outside of Israel and Palestine as well.
Yusuf Munayyer is Senior Fellow at the Arab Center in D.C. Yusuf, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.